I wonder, just by show of hands, how many of you here have ever had a week that didn't go according to plan? Okay, a couple of you. All right, that's good. Well, my week didn't go according to plan, and we were going to start Ruth today. We are now going to start Ruth in 2 weeks. And today, we are going to be visiting a chapter in Philippians, chapter 1. And sometimes life gets a little messy. And God is really good to us in those situations when life gets a little messy. And so I want to share some encouragement with us from Philippians. So you can get your fingers ready in Philippians, chapter 1. When the church was first starting out, I'm trying to remember if this was the very beginning of connection groups here at CPC or if it was towards the tail end when I was doing groups at a previous church. So I don't remember which church this happened at, but I remember what happened in our basement because we had some people over into our house. We were leading a group and they had a three-year-old and the three-year-old was with some other kids in the basement, and we can look back at like what level of supervision was actually happening. I don't know, but I do know that the three-year-old found marker, and when we went downstairs later that night, there was marker all across the walls of the whole basement, on computers, on keyboards, on furniture, on the piano. How many of you know in that moment a dry sponge would not have helped? We could have taken a dry sponge and we could have applied it to that marker, but it wasn't really going to get anything accomplished. Like a sponge with water in it is much better equipped to handle the mess. A sponge that's not saturated has a much harder time in messy situations. Yeah, a dry sponge might be able to handle a few Cheerios on the countertop, but not a real mess. And here's what I want to suggest to us this morning. A life saturated with the gospel is much better equipped to handle messy circumstances. And when life scribbles in crayon all over your walls, dry Christianity is going to be insufficient for joy. It's going to be insufficient for peace. It's going to be insufficient to live from a place of love. There is a connection between saturated with the gospel and living in joy and peace and love. And in Philippians, when we look at the Apostle Paul, we're going to see a man who's dripping with the gospel. And as a result, his joy and his peace in the midst of messy situations was just extraordinary. So this text we're looking at, it's part of a missionary report letter. It was written by Paul while under house arrest. I actually last preached this text during the pandemic when we couldn't meet together for some of those weeks. And I was in a home in Florida. Some of you might remember this. And I preached it to my Zoom camera. And the church watched this. So there was a certain sense that I was under house arrest at the time. We all were for a time. There was a bit of a flashback. As I was prepping this. So Paul knows what it's like, even more than we do, to be stuck in a home. He's under house arrest, and he's writing to this church in Philippi that is supporting him financially, and the church wants to know, how are things going with this missionary that they're giving money to? And at first glance, when you read through Philippians, it almost seems like Paul's giving a report about the gospel and not a report about himself. Like they could have found themselves thinking, wait, Paul, we want to know how you're doing. You're telling us how the gospel is doing. Well, if Paul was a dry sponge, then for him to talk about himself and to talk about the gospel would require two separate reports. But since Paul is saturated with the gospel and it's become kind of part of the warp and woof of who he is, then for Paul to report on how the gospel was doing actually was to report on how he was doing. And so this means, since he was saturated with the gospel, if the gospel's winning, then Paul was winning, and the gospel's always winning. And so no matter the circumstance, Paul was always winning. And since Paul understood that he was always winning, there was joy available. Even in the messiest of circumstances, Paul had constant joy, even though his life was full of sorrows, full of pains. So this, I don't mean the kind of joy that I don't feel any pain, I just feel joy. No, no, no. I'm talking about a joy that can be there even in the midst of the mess, even in the midst of the hardship. And that is a kind of a joy and a kind of a love and a kind of a peace that is available to us. And so the main takeaway this morning that I want to leave you with is that gospel saturation produces joy. Gospel saturation produces joy. And I'm going to share with you this morning three characteristics of gospel saturation. And as we move in, I'm really going to, especially towards the end, connect the dots between how a life saturated in the gospel is the deep answer that we long for and the deep answer that we need. Let's ask the Lord for his help and then we'll jump into the text. So Father God, we come. We know what it's like to be in messy situations. We know what it's like to go through pain. And sometimes we don't know what it's like to have joy and peace in the midst. And we tend to think that we need the messy circumstances to be over or else we can't have the joy and the peace. And God, would you help us to go a level deeper today? Would you help us to learn how to lean into you and find your joy and your peace, not only when the circumstances change, but right there in the midst of the journey? So help us. Amen. So three characteristics of gospel saturation. Number one, gospel saturation sees messy circumstances as strategic God moments. Gospel saturation sees messy circumstances as strategic God moments. So Paul is in messy circumstances. Look with me at Philippians chapter 1, verse 12. Paul says, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me, he's in prison, has really served to advance the gospel. So that has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest, that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I'm put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. So actually, rival preachers were trying to take advantage of Paul while Paul was absent, probably imagining that he's looking on with envy from prison, maybe viewing the prison as a sign of that God wasn't with Paul. And here's Paul's conclusions. So what then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. Wow. Like if your circumstances were that messy, would you have ended your report by saying, I rejoice? Really? I mean, just think about it. I'm in prison. Other Christians, like probably real Christians, but they're trying to get ahead, take advantage of me. And so you want to know how I'm doing, Philippians? I'm rejoicing. Huh. I think I might have written Philippians a little different. We'll call this the reversed standard version, RSV. I would probably say, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has totally messed up my ministry. Everyone knows I'm stuck in jail. I can't do what God called me to do. The brothers are going to see what happened to me and become fearful to speak the word. Even worse, these ambitious rival preachers, they're afflicting me. They're trying to take my place with my people. Like, what then? So please pray, because in every way, life is really hard and I'm filled with sorrow. That's the version I tend to write over my own life. Dry Christianity sees messy circumstances primarily as an obstacle rather than as a strategic God moment. But not Paul. Paul actually sees beyond the mess to something greater. And Paul recognizes that God was there in the messy circumstances. Gospel saturation sees through a God lens. So I want to revisit some of these same verses, and I just want you to notice the God lens that Paul is looking through. He says, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. It's become known to the imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. Most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, they're much more bold to speak the word without fear. What he's saying here is, yeah, okay, I might be stuck at home, but the gospel's not chained. I might be kind of chained, so to speak, but not the gospel, not what matters most. He says, some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. I'm not going to focus on that. Here's what I'm going to focus on. In every way, whether pretense or truth, Christ is proclaimed. And in that I rejoice. Like at the end of the day, after all the efforts of these preachers to further themselves at Paul's expense, they've only succeeded in doing the thing that matters most to him. They've preached Christ. And so Paul knows God is at work in the mess, so he rejoices. And when we are gospel saturated, we view circumstances differently. Messy circumstances, they become strategic God moments. Gospel saturation knows messy circumstances actually lie in God's hands. And God uses these circumstances to advance the gospel. He uses these circumstances actually for our own good, even if we don't think we need the kind of good that he thinks is good for us. And so Paul's attitude is like, oh, I'm in prison? Wow, I wonder what God's up to. What's God doing? And then he starts to find evidence. Oh, look at what God's doing. Oh, I'm facing rejection? Oh, God is up. God's up to something. Let's see what God does with this one. Oh, I'm in financial difficulty. That shows up later in Philippians. It's true. And his attitude is, I can't wait to see what God is doing. What a huge God moment. Like, bring it on. The bigger the mess, the greater the God moment as the gospel triumphs in the midst of it. Not just by ending it, although sometimes that's how God shows his triumph, but in the midst of this, we actually see this all through scripture. It's like strategic God moments might look like a fiery furnace where you actually get condemned by the king, tied up, and thrown into the fire. Strategic God moments might look like a 10-foot tall Goliath. And God doesn't remove Goliath. God actually says, you know, you need to go out and fight him. It might look like a cross. The strategic God moment wasn't, I will remove you from the cross. Christ prayed that prayer. Remember in the garden, would you remove this from me? God's like, no, I'm going to strengthen you. And you're going to walk through this. And this is going to be my grace. Strategic God moments in the scripture sometimes looks like infertility. You probably know the story. Sometimes the strategic God moment looks like a foreign army. Sometimes the strategic God moment looks like the Red Sea. Sometimes the strategic God moment looks like Paul in jail. Sometimes the strategic God moment looks like ridicule. I shared last week that I was praying one of my actually profound prayers. I'm partly sarcastic, but also partly fully authentic, and the prayer was, Lord, help. Lord, help. I don't know if you've ever become, sometimes there's circumstances come together, and part of it's outside of you, and then part of it's your own fault. And you're trying to work through, like, oh, yeah, I have some things I need to work on. And so I'm praying, Lord, help. And the Lord just made it really clear, this is my help. And so my prayer at the time was, I need these things to change, circumstances to change. And God's like, actually, no, this is my care. Sometimes the storm is care. Messy circumstances are not the absence of God. And normal circumstances are the presence of God. God's actually there in the mess. Like, the gospel advances in the mess. Out there in the world and in us, the gospel advances in the mess, not just when life is clean. Messy circumstances are strategic God moments. God is at work in the mess, so we can rejoice in the mess. But dry Christianity loses joy when circumstances get messy, when church gets hard. And when that's us, and if we're honest, isn't this all of us sometimes? So I don't want people to feel condemned if you're having a hard time finding joy. This is all of us. So this text is inviting us how to fight for joy. I don't want you to feel condemned if you don't have it. I know how hard it is in hard circumstances to be able to press in to the love and the joy and the peace, but I also know we tend to bypass the Bible answer for how to go after joy, and it's a lot easier sometimes to just, well, here's how the world goes about it, or here's how I would prefer, and I want to anchor us into the only kind of answer that truly is going to matter. And so dry Christianity loses its joy when circumstances get messy and the church gets hard, and so when I'm in those moments, I have to like kind of evaluate, how saturated am I with the gospel? And if I'm becoming gospel dry, I can have difficulty seeing past the mess. If that's me, I'd be like, well, I don't like it this way, so I'm going to pout. I don't like it this way, so I'm going to retreat. I don't like it this way, I'm going to quit. And I'm not saying that there's never times in life where you should retreat on something or quit on something. But I think you understand what I'm saying. We're trying to look into our own hearts. For a dry sponge, joy tends to get tethered to normal. It tends to get tethered to, in Paul's case, to freedom or to finances being a certain way. But Paul didn't have freedom. He didn't have normal. He didn't have finances. But what he did have was gospel saturation, and so that mess wasn't his primary focus. Now, this is a quick caveat. I'm going to give a number of caveats as we move along. I don't want to imply, like, messes are really hard. Life can get really painful. I don't want to at all imply that if you're in a really hard situation, really painful situation, that, and you don't have all this joy, and it's really hard to smile, that you're bad or that you're failing. I get it. I get that it's hard, okay? So don't feel any condemnation here, but do feel an invitation. Like, even in that, the gospel can be an answer that brings love and joy and peace into our life. And so let's look at Paul and be like, could I have had that kind of joy in that kind of circumstance? What did Paul maybe know that I didn't? Or what did Paul press more deeply into than maybe I have? And this text is inviting us not to make our joy prisoner to messy circumstances. It's inviting us not to live for next, not to live for that day down the road that hasn't yet arrived and miss right now. Like, God doesn't only work after the mess is over. God doesn't only work in spite of the mess. God actually is at work through the mess. God works during the mess. In the movie Click, Adam Sandler, that great theologian, he plays an architect who finds this universal remote that allows him to fast forward or to mute or to rewind different parts of his life. And so soon he's muffling the barks of the family dog. He's zooming past irritating moments with his wife. But he learns that skipping forward to next actually isn't the secret to joy in life. He learns that life is as much about the moments he'd rather forget as the moments he would tend to prefer to remember. And Paul knew this. Paul wasn't living for next and missing out on now. He's actually embracing the moment that he had, regardless of its imperfections. Paul didn't push pause on ministry until normalcy could resume. He knew this moment right now, this is the God moment. I read, one theologian commented on this passage, the God of the Bible typically works not through the channels of economic and political power that are so accessible to us in the Western world, but through the weakness and suffering that the world tells us to avoid at all costs. And so as I was praying the other week, so I felt like the Lord said that this was his help. And then as I was praying the following day, I just felt this gratitude rise up in me. The oddest thing, because I actually felt it. Sometimes you do things because it's right, but every so often the Lord enables you to feel what is right. And those are wonderful moments. And I was just thinking about the hard things that were going on, the some of the circumstances in my life. And there was my heart got quiet and got surrendered. And it's like, God, thank you so much for this. I need this. I don't know exactly what he's up to. I don't know why he's doing it this way. But I was like, I need this. And isn't that what James says in James 1, count it all joy when you fall into various trials? I love that James is various trials because it might be suffering, it might be things outside, it might be things that are your own fault. We fall into those trials and life can get hard. And he says that this is going to produce patience in you, like let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. God works. He's at work through our weakness. He's at work through our suffering. And let's let patience have its perfect work so that we can be perfect and complete. So the first characteristic of gospel saturation is that gospel saturation sees messy circumstances as strategic God moments. Second characteristic, gospel saturation focuses on the message more than the messenger. So focusing primarily on the message is evidenced by rejoicing. So let's go back to some of these verses. Verse 15, Paul says, some preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. Verse 17, he says, the former proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. What then? And notice how he's focused mainly on the message. Only that in every way, whether pretense or truth, Christ is proclaimed. And in that, I rejoice. And so here, Paul's actually rejoicing because of the message. Christ is proclaimed. And since Paul is saturated, since his life is caught up in this purpose, since this is his very identity, when the gospel wins, he wins. Yeah, but Paul, those people are flawed. Those they might be proclaiming Christ, but they're flawed. They're messed up leaders. They got problems with their motives. They got sin in their life. And yep, it's true. It's true, unfortunately. But Paul's actually not basing his rejoicing on a messenger. He's not basing his rejoicing on a human person. He's basing his rejoicing on the message. A quick caveat here. Paul does not rejoice in spite of a flawed gospel. Sometimes it can be confusing when you read Paul, like, why is he so gracious here and so harsh here? Like over in Galatians 9, he's like, if anyone preaches a different gospel than the one I preach, let him be accursed. And he even goes so far as to say some of those men should just castrate themselves, cut themselves off. Like, wait, how come he's so firm there? And here he's like, whatever, Christ is being preached. Well, in Galatians, the gospel was at stake, a flawed message. He's not going to rejoice in a flawed message going. He never tolerates a false gospel. But these envious evangelists, they were preaching the true gospel. These other leaders Paul's talking about, they're proclaiming Christ. The Galatian In Galatians, that's not what was going on. Paul never tolerates a false gospel. But here, he can rejoice. In spite of the fact these people, all right, they're kind of messed up. Rival preachers, they got selfishness and ambition in their heart. He still rejoices. But when we're dry, if it's hard, if the gospel's not fully penetrating, it's a lot harder to rejoice like this. We end up having a very different experience. And focusing primarily on the messenger is evidenced by negative symptoms. And so we actually can test ourselves right now. I can ask myself the question. I invite you to ask yourself the question. Am I gospel focused in the midst of my messy circumstance? And here's how we can know if maybe not. So I'm just going to, here's some symptoms. One would be vilification. I'm going to quote one comment on this passage. This is an important word for the Christian community who are often quick to vilify people. There will be preachers and teachers who do things that make us cringe. But are they preaching Christ? If so, then we should rejoice. And then we should pray about their questionable motives. Our hearts are deceptive, and even the best of preachers can do dumb things for bad reasons. This does not excuse their sin. I just pointed out for us to remember the centrality of the gospel and the weakness of human instruments. We should examine ourselves. Are we vilifying people? I do want to give a caveat here. I'm not talking about excusing abuse and where there's an abusive situation, saying, oh, that person's only human, God uses weak instruments. That's not what I'm getting at right now. I'm not talking about excusing poor theology. You know, well, okay, they don't got the gospel right, but God uses weak. There's a different approach there. I'm not talking about cover-ups that take place. Like, there is a time to call things out. And I'm definitely not asking you to excuse my mistakes. That this is not just let Barry do whatever. He's a flawed leader. That's actually not what I'm talking about right here. Okay? So there are ways that people need to be called out, and there are situations we need to step in. But in general, there's a general truth that in most cases, even good Christian leaders are flawed. Even good Christian leaders are going to make mistakes. And if we are vilifying those kind of people, then it might be an indication that maybe I'm not as gospel saturated as Paul. So vilification would be one of the symptoms. Bitterness would be one of these symptoms. Paul could have been bitter. Here he is, giving himself for the church. And it seems like other church leaders are kind of getting ahead of his expense or not recognizing what he's going through. They're trying to take advantage of him. Whether or not they're doing it intentionally or not, it's hard to know. But it seems like they're trying to take advantage of him while he's in prison. But since he has this gospel focus, he's able to rejoice. And since he has this gospel focus, he keeps on keeping on. But if we're not gospel focused, when we encounter flawed messengers, something in us begins to dry up. And if we're dry, when we experience the flawed leaders, which is me, and it's all of us, and then some are too flawed, and I get that. But if we're dry, when we experience the flawed leaders in a flawed church, we end up getting hurt and withdrawing. But Paul is actually taking a different approach. Like, if anyone could have legitimately been hurt and withdrew, it was Paul. But instead, Paul decided, I'm going to pattern myself after Christ. And what did Christ do? Christ gave himself on behalf of a church that's deeply flawed. Us, okay? Let's not talk about those other churches. Us. People. The church is people. Maybe you're not deeply flawed, but I am. And Christ gave himself on behalf of me. He gave himself on behalf of a church that's flawed. He didn't quit on the church because it is flawed. So I'm not going to quit, and we should not quit on one another when we are flawed. Like, we're going to be hurt. I've hurt people. I've apologized more times than I can count. That wasn't my plan in planting a past church. I'm going to plant a church, and my job is going to be the first foremost apologizer. Well, guess what? That's been one of the things that has characterized the last 8 years. I'm going to hurt you. I've been hurt by people in the church deeply. And that's not, I'm not pointing fingers at anybody right now. Like, that's the way it works. And we tend to think, well, I guess this is not God then, because this is painful. It's like, actually, maybe this is the strategic God moment. Maybe I'm going to lean in. Maybe God is actually working through this hurt, maybe through these difficulties, maybe through these conversations. And so bitterness can be a sign. I'm not saying just tolerate hurt and let it. So don't read more into this than I intend. But we've got to examine our heart. Is there a bitterness? Is there a root of bitterness here? Am I saturated by the gospel? Do I look like Paul? Do I look like Christ? Another symptom of focusing primarily on the messenger is envy and ambition. So Paul says in verse 15, some preach Christ from envy and rivalry out of selfish ambition. And Paul could have done the same thing right back. He could have been envious. He could have felt like, this is hard for me. I'm trying to do this and they're getting in the way. But his ambition actually wasn't for personal advancement. His ambition was for gospel advancement. And so he didn't view even these flawed messengers as rivals, even though they saw him that way. See, dry Christianity has this hidden ambition that can to lead to envy. And so we should ask ourselves questions like, am I constantly comparing myself to others? Do I rejoice when my friends succeed? Or do I grow jealous? Do I resent it when others are praised, especially if there are people that got problems? Can't other people see the problems this person has? Do I resent if I don't get the praise that I got overlooked? Like, don't people see what I'm doing? Envy and ambition can be signs of areas where the gospel's not saturating our heart yet. And so these negative symptoms, they're actually evidence that I might have a diseased focus. I'm trying to talk in I language and invite you to identify with me, because I'm not trying to say you have a diseased focus. But these negative symptoms can be evidence that there's a disease. I remember when my daughter, the very beginning of her cancer journey, it was the neck got swollen real big. And some of you didn't know that was a story in our life. It is. God was good. We're past that. But the swollen neck was a symptom. Something's going on. And we need to get to the root of this. What is it that needs treatment? And when we have these symptoms of vilifying people or roots of bitterness or envy and ambition, that should be as simple. Okay, my neck's a little swollen. What's going on? There's some treatment that's needed. What's going on? And maybe you can look at your life and maybe you can see these symptoms of, oh, there's parts of my Christianity that might be a little dry. Maybe you can't find any joy or peace in the midst of your messy circumstances. Maybe you're seeing bitterness in your life or envy in your life or a tendency to vilify people in your life. And there's really good news in this text, and it's that there is treatment available. And it's the gospel of Jesus. And that brings us to the third characteristic of gospel saturation. So we've seen the gospel saturation sees messy circumstances as strategic God moments. We've seen that gospel saturation focuses on the message more than the messenger. And lastly, we're going to see that gospel saturation is the cure for dry Christianity. Some cures, you take this pill, and your sore muscles are immediately not sore. Some cures, like the toenail fungus I'm trying to get rid of, and I went to the doctor, and they said, paint your nails with this. It's going to probably take 6 months. Okay, great. But I've had ugly toenails for decades, so I probably survive another 6 months. That is the way for me to eventually have pristine toenails. They're going to be elegant. I will probably start wearing sandals. So some cures, this is something that we lean into. This is something that we do over time. This is something that has to saturate into our hearts, that takes a while to get into our hearts. But gospel saturation is the cure. So don't think of it as the pill that, well, I tried that and 2 hours later, I still felt the same. This is one of those, if you lean into this over time, it changes you. So I want to kind of connect some of the dots and show you how gospel saturation is the cure for dry Christianity, starting with that soaking in the gospel gives you joy in messy circumstances. And here's why. It's because the gospel is always winning. So Christ said that nothing is going to be able to stop the church. Nothing's going to be able to stop this message. And it started in this little tiny group of scared people in Jerusalem with a crucified Messiah. And it has continued to spread to the ends of the earth. So there's billions of Christians, and it's going to continue to spread until Christ returns. The gospel's always winning. So even though there's ebbs and flows to our own life, we got to keep track of the big picture, that there is a winning that's taking place to the ends of the earth. We're on the right side. We're on the right team. And that will begin to give us some joy. It also helps because the gospel reveals to us that God is passionate for your provision. So before you even knew you had a need, before you were even born to know that you were going to have sins in your life that should have separated you from God forever, before you were going to even know that there's such a thing as a hell that you would need to be saved from, and there's such a wonderful thing as a relationship with God and heaven, God was already looking down. It's like, I'm going to make a pathway available for you so that you can step into my joy forever. God went to the cross for your need before you even knew you had a need. And you, whenever you wonder, how passionate is God for my provision? My life is really messy right now. Does God really care? Is God really being good right now? How far is God really going to go on my behalf? I want you to know that when you soak in the gospel, it gives you the answer. How far will he go on your behalf? To the cross, from heaven to earth, to a fleshly body, through suffering and rejection and vilification and being reviled and being stripped naked and being whipped and being crucified. That's how far he's going to go on your behalf. Don't ever lose sight of that. The moment you start losing sight of that, circumstances take over and you start to wonder, God's the problem or people are the problem. No, God's passionate for your provision. He's actually already providing for you in ways you don't even know yet. Soaking in the gospel, when that's the narrative that we let to control our life, it gives you joy in messy circumstances. The gospel shows us that God works for our good and he's always up to something good in your life. The gospel shows us that God takes what Satan might have meant for evil, what men might have meant for evil, and he transforms that into something glorious. The gospel shows us God gives us the grace that we need. He gives us the grace we need. The gospel shows us God takes initiative to solve our problems. And can you see how when you begin to soak in this, you're going to have a little bit of a different perspective on the circumstances you are in? And there's going to be some joy? Like, why did some people just all of a sudden start to clap? Not because, oh, Barry, that's good preaching. You may have thought that. But really what was happening is something in our heart was unlocking, right? Isn't that what's going on? The good news of the gospel is speaking to me right now, speaking to my circumstances. I don't know if I understand everything, but something is right about this. Soaking in the gospel gives you joy in messy circumstances. All right, how else is gospel saturation the cure for dry Christianity? Soaking in the gospel cures envy. I'll have to do this. There is nothing that can affirm you more than the cross has. So Christ actually, he won the gold medal. Christ came to earth. He lived the life that we couldn't live. He was perfectly loving, perfectly forgiving. He didn't offend people sinfully. He only offended them in the right way by speaking the right truths at the right time. He ministered to the poor. He called out injustice. He spoke truth. He was obedient to the point of death. He was generous. Like, he lived perfectly. He earned the gold medal. He is exalted high above all else. And then he calls us up onto his podium. You are seated with Christ in the heavenly places. You are joined to the one who is exalted above all. And I ask you, why would a gold medalist need to be envious? When we understand what the gospel has done for us, how much the gospel has affirmed us, if God is for us, who can be against us? Who is to condemn? We're affirmed by the one with the greatest worth imaginable. Okay, this person's not affirming me. This person sees my flaws. This person thinks I'm flawed in an area that's actually not true. I can't control that. If you're like me, I don't mind if people think that I'm better than I am, but it bothers me a lot if people think I'm worse than I actually am. But that is really like, where am I looking to for my affirmation? And what value am I placing on people's affirmation versus God's affirmation? And when I understand what God is saying about me, when I understand where my position is in Christ, it really changes. Nothing can affirm me more than the cross has. I have the highest place. Why would a gold medalist be envious? And because Christ has looked to my interests and Christ has affirmed me and Christ has already determined that I'm going to be a success in the ways that matter most, that means I can be freed to look to the interests of others. I don't need to be envious of them. I don't need to care if they look better than me. I don't need to care if they get ahead. My security, my affirmation's already secure. Amen. Soaking in the gospel cures envy. Soaking in the gospel cures vilification. Here's what the gospel does to that person. You know who that person is. That person that you would want to vilify. And you probably don't use that word. No, you have godly discernment. Okay, that person that you have godly discernment towards. The gospel says that you are more like them than unlike them. The gospel says that you too are messed up. The gospel says it's not only them that Christ needed to come and die for. It's not only they who needed forgiveness. You, me, needed Christ to die for you. Needed forgiveness. We are more like those people that we want to vilify than unlike them. There's only one perfect messenger, only one perfect leader. It's Jesus. And actually, he could have vilified us. He could rightly have pointed out all our flaws. But he didn't. You know what he did? On the cross, Christ, he took the vilification we deserved so that we could get the affirmation that he deserved. Oh my goodness! When you soak in that, it's going to change your tendency to vilify people. If you start from the place of, okay, how am I more like that person than unlike that person? You will begin to see things in your own life like, oh, actually, I'm kind of like that sometimes too. And you will also see, oh, maybe this is where they're coming from. I can see it now. Soaking in the gospel cures vilification. The cross shows us God delights in mercy. It shows us God loves the undeserving, and so that's the way that we're called to be. One last demonstration of how gospel saturation is the cure for dry Christianity. Soaking in the gospel cures bitterness. It cures bitterness. Because the good news, here's why. The good news of the gospel, it's that actually we have received better than we deserved, not worse than we deserved. And bitterness tends to come from this place of, I deserve better. Can't people see how hard I'm trying? Can't people see how much love I have? Can't people see how I'm trying to advance the cause of the gospel? Can't people see how I'm there for their gospel? Can't people see my good heart? Can't people see that I'm trying? Can't And sometimes there's more pride in it. Can't people see that I am the person for this? Like, I've got this. Like, don't you see my skills? Like, there's all sorts of things that can lead to bitterness. So bitterness tends to come from, like, I think I deserve better. I think I deserve their understanding. I think they should be kind of seeing my heart more. I think they're probably missing what I've been doing. I think they should see my circumstances more. That's where bitterness tends to come from. We tend to think that we deserve better than we're getting, and actually the cross shows us what we deserved. So the cross shows us how much we matter to God and the great worth that he placed on us through the cross, but it also shows us what we deserved, and it shows us that we are getting far better than we deserve. God is the God who gives us far more than we deserve. People might not always do that. I might not give you what you deserve. And if that's been me, I'm sorry. I'm literally. It's going to happen. It's going to happen in the church. We're going to mess this up. But there's one person who's never going to mess it up. The one who could have given us what we truly deserve actually gives us better than we deserve. And this gives us a lot of freedom when it comes to seeing the mess in someone else's life. Maybe they are kind of part of the problem. The cross gives us confidence because it shows us God doesn't ignore evil. How far is God willing to go to deal with evil? I mean, I don't understand why evil exists, but I do know that God cared so much about it that he came into this evil world and he experienced evil in this world, and he went to the cross for the consequences for my evil, and then he's promising that through this, he's going to remake the entire world and completely remove evil, so I don't have to worry about, well, I think I need to take the vengeance. I think I need to fix this. No, the gospel tells me God's already at work. He's already got a plan for dealing with evil, so I don't need to be bitter against it. God is going to take care of it, and then the final chapter of the gospel is that justice is going to prevail for all eternity. That person that's hurt you, that person that you're mad at, those hard circumstances, God actually has a plan for that. He's either going to change their heart, or he's going to lead them into their own messy circumstances and begin to expose their heart, or they're going to be separated from him for all eternity. Like, we can trust that God's got this, and our bitterness is not the answer to evil. The gospel enables us to be free from bitterness, and we're getting better than we deserve. Well, if that's the way God is towards me, that we love him because he first loved us, and now his love is in me, so I can start loving other people the same way. Instead of bitterness, there can be love, there can be understanding. And so because of the gospel, we have many reasons to rejoice. And so don't let messy circumstances and flawed leaders rob you of your joy. Soak in the gospel. Connect the dots from the gospel to life. By that, I don't mean ignore pain, pretend it's not there. I don't mean that. And we should try to work through these things. And there is also a certain sense in which pain is an enemy. And it's okay to identify that. I don't agree with this theology that is unwilling to state the truth of what's happening in our life. If it's pain, we can name it. We can call it bad. But let's also not lose sight of the fact that in the midst of that, God can be working through it. God can be using it. It can be a strategic moment. It can actually be the path that he has for us. And I feel like that's what the Lord has told me these past couple weeks. It's like, Barry, this path actually is my goodness. Don't fight it. So there are times when you should fight, you should stand up, and there are other times when, okay, I need to be still and know that he is God. And this is the path for me. And he's going to decide the end of this path, what it looks like. I can trust him. I would like to recommend a resource. If you're like me, it can be, when you hear a message like this, it can kind of make sense. Oh yeah, the gospel connects. But then tomorrow, like, wait, how did the gospel connect again? Like, how does the gospel help bitterness? I can't. There's a book called Gospel Fluency. There might still be a copy in our bookstore, but it also might have been purchased. It's by a guy named Jeff Vanderstelt. And this Gospel Fluency, it's about, how do we do this? How do you connect the dots between what Christ has done for you and your life? How do we as a community connect the dots between the gospel and our life together, our living together? And so I would just Man, if 150 people from our church would read that book and soak in it for a while, it would have an absolutely transformational effect on who we are. And so I would commend it to you.